number one for a reason. The best content you'll find on your radio. This is Primetime Sports with Bob McCowan on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
What is the thought process with this song? How does this in any way fit the theme or the mood? It's alphabetical? That's the criteria around here. Great. All right, can we get rid of that, please? Thank you. Holy cow. Somebody shoot me. Oh, hello. It's Friday, May the 24th, 2013, and the roundtable has assembled such that it is. Here are the collection of characters I must deal with for the next 2 hours. You, of course, have options. To my left, John Shannon. To my right, Gordon Kirk. To my far right, Paul Jones. And off we go. Not even a comment, huh?
Well, there's a comment there about in the blue corner, in the red corner, in the...
Well,
hey, glad you didn't make that comment.
Let us begin on the diamond, if you will. The Toronto Blue Jays have now won 8 of their last 11. It's premature to suggest that the ship has indeed been put back on course and that this team is at least now capable of fighting their way back into the race. There's time to do it. They're going to have to keep up this kind of pace for a little while, though, in order to get back into it. But have you seen stuff you like over the last 10, 12 days that suggest that maybe they can?
I've seen pitchers who should be pitching coming back into form, and you know, the veterans that look like they may have peaked and been over the edge as far as their careers go, but they're looking not bad now. Dickey and Burley, et cetera. I mean, Morrow's struggling. I don't know what's up with Morrow. Romero, well, no sense talking about Romero, but I do think overall the pitching's coming back in, the veterans you counted on. And you got the guy, Jose Reyes, who I think was the key acquisition in the offseason, if you had to pick one. When he's back, I think you've got a lot to hope for.
Not to make too much out of this, but today I happened to take a look at the batting averages, and I hadn't looked at them for maybe all season long, the individual batting averages.
Not thrilling.
Anybody know what Jose Reyes was hitting before he
395?
395.
Yeah. To me, that's the biggest thing. Like 12 runs
samples,
last night.
Small sample
offense,
size.
They're starting to – this lineup that, you know, everybody talked about the pitching rotation. You look at the lineup, this lineup was supposed to be able to put some runs on the board, and they're finally starting to do that.
Half-jokingly, I'm not even worried about the pitching staff. If you can score 10, 12 every game,
right,
you know, and we'll just keep on doing
it. Who needs
it, right?
Pitchers?
Yeah. I mean, and you talk about veterans breaking out. I mean, Bautista finally appears to be back where he is supposed to be. And
Cabrera's been good, although he's been a little banged up.
Yeah, and
Encarnacion
has
runs hot and cold, which he always does.
So, all of the guys that you expected to hit the long ball are hitting the long ball, and they can score runs. And that, to me, is... I mean, I'm one of those guys. I like 8-7 games. I know that it drives every purist nuts, but...
Earl Weaver over there, play for the 3-run homer.
Oh, sure. Well, hey, listen, this team, there have been times this team, that's all this team has been doing is playing for the home run ball.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it's a positive or a negative, but, I mean, right now they're winning in spite of a... You know, we all talk about, people in baseball talk about, your strength has to come up the middle. And if the strength isn't up the middle, you're not going to win long term. And this team, even now, I mean, it's pretty shaky up the middle. You've got a shortstop that really has, you know, as nice a guy as he may be and as colorful as he is, he has no business being in the major leagues. You really don't have a second baseman. Esturas is hitting under 200.
Yeah.
Bonifacio is hitting under 200 when he plays there. Aaron Sibbia is still questionable defensively and offensively, other than hitting the long ball. I had a pretty good day yesterday, but he struck. I mean, between he and Rasmus,
I was going to say, we haven't mentioned your favorite player yet, Bob.
Well, but I mean, Rasmus looks like a star offensively compared to Aaron Sibbia because, I mean, Aaron Sibbia's on-base percentage is like 250. I mean, that's really bad. That is really bad. At least Rasmus is over 300.
I'm glad you mentioned Aaron Sibbia's defense, though. That still remains a major concern for me. Terrific guy, great team guy, apparently. It gives you occasional offense, can go deep. But he's got to block those balls. He's got to pick up his defense.
The other thing that bothers me, and I've talked to John a little bit about this, is this guy's penchant for not framing pitches and taking pitches out of the strike zone with the way he receives the ball. He doesn't catch with soft hands. He doesn't bring the ball back into the strike zone. I can't tell you how many pitches I believe umpires would have called a strike, except Aaron Sibbia moves his hands away from the strike zone as he catches them. If you watch Molina the other day, and we all know that Molina, he was a Blue Jay.
Yeah.
He has great limitations.
Yeah.
But he's a very good defensive catcher.
He is.
And Molina sits back there, gives the pitcher the big target, and then frames the pitch. He catches it with soft hands, and he holds it there for the umpire. Whereas when Aaron Sibbia catches it, invariably he's moving. When he catches it and taking the ball out of the strike zone. And umpires are not going to give you those pitches. So it hurts the pitching staff as much as it hurts, you know, the defense.
Yeah. Isn't that something he can learn, though? I mean, and
this is something he should have learned.
Okay, but I'm saying that's
my puzzlement.
Paul, this is a conversation Bob had in the first 6 months that Aaron Sibbia was here as a rookie. And literally word for word, the same conversation about where the glove is, where the glove should be, how you move the glove at the appropriate time. I mean, that's 3 years ago, isn't it?
Well, it's over two.
Third season. Yeah. But he wasn't. Was he supposed to be the catcher of record? It was supposed to be Darno, wasn't it? I mean,
yeah, you know,
well, who knows?
The other thing about it, he seems to be very sensitive. There was a game, I guess, that didn't involve Dickey as a pitcher, and they used Blanco as the starting catcher, and apparently Aaron Sibbia was. His nose was out of joint about it. But they've got to make a statement to him. They've got to reach this guy somehow. They're not going to be a championship team without a catcher who can catch properly.
Well, I think we're getting close to the point where you have to start thinking about bringing Josh Tolley up. I think you're almost at that point. Now, Tolley may not be a great major league catcher, but he caught for the Mets for a couple years. Now, that's not saying much, I grant you. The Mets are not exactly a juggernaut.
Easy on my team, okay?
But Tolley is a guy who's had more than a cup of coffee at the major league level. I think last year he caught 100 games for the Mets.
Yeah.
I thought he'd be here more to catch.
And statistically.
To catch Dickey.
Dickey.
Yeah, that's
I thought
he'd be here
more to
catch
Dickey. That's what
I thought. He'd be here to catch Dickey, and
well,
that would be
his
catcher.
I think now you're in a situation. Blanco can't hit. Blanco's 41 years old. Blanco can catch Dickey, but so can Tolley. I think we're getting
close.
If
the rest of the offense is going, though, Bobcat, isn't that all you need the guy to do? Catch?
Yeah, but Aaron Sibbia doesn't give you that. So that's why I'm saying, I think if you can get Tolley up here, and at the very least, Tolley's going to get more opportunities to catch than Blanco can and is. I don't know. I don't think Tolley's going to, he certainly hasn't got the power that Aaron Sibbia has, but there's oodles of power on this team. You're not going to miss that home run swing.
Yeah. Have we heard how Tolley's doing on the farm? I have no recollection.
Can we get a number on Josh Tolley? I looked about a week or so ago, and his batting average was respectable.
Oh.
I want to say it was 270 or 280.
Oh, that's good.
That's down there.
And everybody in Buffalo is hitting like stupid.
You can't blame the air in Buffalo this year, Bob.
No.
You used to blame the air in Las Vegas.
You used
to blame the Vegas air. You can't blame it in Buffalo.
Aaron Buffalo is pretty heavy.
It takes me back to the Tony Fernandez story when Fernandez was playing in the Pacific Coast League and hit 300. And Tony Baloney Kubek was raving on how great this guy was and noted that this is a guy, shortstop, who hit 300. Do you know where he ranked that year in batting?
No.
In the PCL? 91st.
At 300.
He was at 91st hitting 300.
Tommy Hutton was the first guy I heard talk about the air out there and how the numbers are inflated, and that's when I started to keep an eye on it. But look, if the guy can hit and give you a little bit and you think that's the issue, then bring him up to catch. Like we were talking about a minute ago, if the offense is going, you don't need that much from him.
Yeah.
You don't need that much.
Did you say Tolley was hitting 342? 342, 5 home runs, 23 RBIs at Buffalo.
It's time to have a look at this guy.
Oh,
Your Honor, I rest my case.
Hey, by the way, great interview with Gillick about the late Epi Guerrero. Yeah. I mean, it's an important statement to make. Epi was so fundamental to this organization.
Oh, absolutely.
And you'd mentioned that you hadn't gotten down to the Dominican Republic. I was telling John before the show that it was very funny because the compound that Epi had down there, I was down there four or five times, and it was hidden way into the tropical forest. And I went down one time with a U.S. senator who commented that he wished that the U.S. air bases were as carefully hidden as Epi's compound. You couldn't find Epi's compound.
Really,
unless,
huh?
Oh, yeah.
That was deliberate?
It was deliberate. Epi didn't want people coming unless he invited the people. He didn't want people dropping by to see who he had in
Yeah, he
in
was
camp.
Working with.
That's right.
Now, he was quite a guy, and I said to Pat, I didn't know him well. I used to see him really just to say hello to, and usually at spring training.
Right.
Every once in a while, you'd run into him at the ballpark, but he was only up here a couple times a year, really.
Yeah, not much.
So I didn't get to see him that often, but he was around at spring training all the time. And he'd usually be around the Dominican guys, and as often as not, acting as interpreter.
Yes.
For the guys.
Yeah. It's so fundamental. I mean, I would love to see him recognized in some meaningful way by the Jays at this point.
Would you put him up on the wall?
I'd consider it.
Really?
I mean, he was that key.
With some of the guys he got here?
I can't argue that.
With some of the guys he got here?
Wow.
Some of the guys he found and got here?
I am not discounting his value and his contribution to the organization, but that's a pretty big leap.
Yeah, it's a big leap.
I mean, when you consider
you.
Others, I mean, yeah. Others within the organization, you know, is Bobby Maddox on the wall? Should Bobby Maddox be
well,
on the wall?
Well, for me, he would be.
But now I'm easy on the wall.
I mean,
that's an interesting question. His acknowledgement. I don't think. I mean, the fact that we ended up talking about, and I say this with full reverence, a scout, a bird dog, on this show, it tells you his impact.
Yeah, yeah.
But the walls. That's
yeah.
That's
but he was
something.
Much more than that. I mean, he literally he. The Dodgers were the first to really mine the Dominican players, but they never did it in the same fashion the Blue Jays did. And when the Blue Jays determined to go in there, and the Dodgers at that point weren't doing as much in the Dominican, they'd sort of backed off a little bit. The Blue Jays owned the Dominican.
Well, you might argue he was almost like a general manager for them in the Dominican.
It was exactly what he was.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, not just a scout. I mean, when you think of the guys he found and got them here.
But he created an
and
empire.
And developed them. Yeah.
Created an empire that precluded almost any other organization from getting a foothold. Mm-hmm. Because what he managed to do was make the entire island a Blue Jay island.
Yes. That's the only team they knew. Yeah.
And nobody they didn't want to play for anybody else. Yeah. The Blue Jays were the team. They're heroes. From the early days, played for the Blue Jays. They watched them on television, and the Blue Jays owned that island. And look, Gillick had a role, and Beeston maybe had a role, and Bavese probably had a role.
And that wasn't lost on the players either, Bob. I remember being in the locker room at the end of the year, one year, and in his gruff way, George Bell was going around the locker room and grabbing the shoes. Hey, you, give me shoes. And he had a big box there, and he was collecting all the shoes, and I looked at him, I said, George, shoes. He goes, they're going back to the Dominican for the kids.
Yeah.
Well, we talked to Gillick yesterday about that and asked if he could even calculate how many bats, balls, gloves, shoes were sent to the Dominican. I mean, it was in the thousands and tens of thousands.
So here's the silly question. And Pat really was trying to be diplomatic. Why did it stop? Because it stopped. And is that reflective of the swoon in the Blue Jay talent base as well?
I mean, I don't want to put a finger on it because I don't know this to be true. But after Pat left and Gordy took over, I think there was a Epi sort of disenfranchised himself from the Blue Jays. And I think there was a falling out.
Was it the way he was treated? Because Pat, I mean, you know, we all know Pat. Pat's a people person, right? The way he deals with people and just a very good way about him. All of a sudden, if he's not around, and with no disrespect to Gord, if Epi's not being dealt with the right way and he doesn't feel like he's wanted or comfortable and he takes a step back,
let's be careful because I don't think any of us know exactly what happened.
I'm just saying.
But you were around the team.
I was around. Epi was a very sensitive guy and he appreciated being adored. And who doesn't, right? Those of us who have experienced that, none of which are in this room. but the thing about Epi and his insecurity or his need for affection, it was fulfilled by Gillick, because Gillick treated him like a brother. They called each other brother, and they acted that way. So I don't know that you could blame Gordy Ash. I don't know that there's anybody who could have stepped in after Gillick and maintained that relationship. It was that kind of close.
No,
so
it's a sad loss at age 71, which is far too soon. But certainly, he left his mark on the organization, and specifically to those who had the great privilege of being on the inside and around that team, because he didn't get much publicity. He wasn't talked about in the media very much. Fans may be familiar with the name. The hardcore Blue Jay fan may know the name, but really wouldn't know the entire story of what Epi built and how he contributed to the success of the Blue Jays, right through to players that contributed on the two World Series teams in 92 and 93. There were Epi guys on that team still.
Well, indirectly, Alomar and Carter came here because of two Epi guys. They traded Fernandez and McGriff, who mm-hmm. were both Epi proposals or recommendations. And they were the weapons that were used to get Alomar and Carter.
Right. What do we think back to this Blue Jay team? What are the prospects for the immediate future? This is a team that still has holes in the pitching staff. They have two guys, two of their starters from opening day, still not with the team. Johnson's recovery return seems to be on track, although it's a ways away. Mm. Hap. There's nowhere to be seen.
Yeah. It's on the 60-day disabled now.
Yeah, nowhere to be seen. You've got the two kids, Drabek and Hutchison, who apparently are on course, but they're not going to be ready until August, September at the earliest, and then you don't even know what you're going to get with them. So there's still going to be some patching to do here.
I just think because of the start they had, they're in a decent spot right now, considering the way things started off. And what magnified the start and made it worse were the expectations. So not only did they have a bad start, it with where they were and what people expected, that gap seemed huge. Like you said, not that they're in a great spot right now, but at least it looks like they've got the ship kind of pointed towards the right direction. They keep hitting, and there are a lot of people, I mean, on Twitter, people are saying, well, you know, you can't just say it's a long season. But it is. I mean, we're at the end of May. We're at the end of May. There's still time if they can kind of keep it going.
Holding their breath, getting close to 500 by All-Star, and hopefully at that point Reyes is back, changes the whole chemistry of this club.
And, can.
Actually, I've really enjoyed listening to Jack Morris on the radio. And he's been a proponent of that very fact of just, you know, slowly moving towards the 500 mark by early July. And then at that point, thinking that Reyes would be healthy. Because as soon as Reyes comes back, a lot of those domino effects of that lineup move to the proper position.
Absolutely.
And that becomes a factor.
You were right again. As you say, if you can hold the opposition to six or seven runs, you got a shot.
Well, if you score 12, I mean, what's the problem?
Yeah,
you know what
that's
I mean?
Right.
And you know,
well, the best part about yesterday was they scored 12 with eight walks. And this is a team that, I mean, you've got to have bad pitching on the other side to get the eight walks out of these guys.
Well, they're going to.
Because they go up there and they're hacking.
Yeah.
The Jays are going to put another young guy on the mound tonight, in Sean Nolan. And, I mean, this will be they brought the 40-year-old guy last week, Ortiz, and then they had one earlier in Boston. So they've really. The whole Buffalo experiment, by the way, really appears to be working, being able to bring guys up the QEW quickly. If the pitching staff can be put together with gaffer's tape for a while, and they can keep hitting, then maybe there is a chance to get to 500.
Actually, I think Nolan's coming up from Double A, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Yes, yeah. You're right.
Yeah. Which is, it used to be the most common thing. Their next level of pitchers, usually they tried to keep it Double A because they didn't want to send anybody out to Las Vegas because you just get whacked on out there.
Yes.
Blue Jays and the Orioles tonight here on Sportsnet and many of these fan radio network stations. The Raptors announced that Brian Colangelo is out as general manager, but curiously will remain as president, but won't have any responsibility in dealing with the general manager who replaces him. Confused? I think they all are at MLSE. We'll talk about it and try and unconfuse it when Primetime continues on The Fan and Sportsnet.
Ian Lang in the morning, Monday, starting at 5:30 a.m. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Twenty-seven minutes past the hour. Primetime continues for this Monday, Friday. Oh, God. Friday, May the 24th, 2013. McCowan, Shannon, Kirk, and Jones around the table. Moving on. So the Toronto Raptors announced that Brian Colangelo would be out as general manager of the Toronto Raptors. That's not totally surprising. But that he would stay on as president of the Toronto Raptors, that's a little more surprising. But that as president, he would have nothing to do with the basketball operation, and the general manager, whoever they hired, would report directly to Tim Lewicki, circumventing Brian Colangelo. And furthermore, if Brian Colangelo wants to leave, he can leave at any time he wants.
How is this different than Brian Burke's dismissal and hiring as a senior advisor?
Well, but they made
which
him
never occurred, by the way.
Well, but they made him a senior advisor, which we all know is a synonym for we got to pay you, so we're going to make you do something. He didn't make him president of the club, or they didn't leave him as president of the club, did they? He was president and general manager.
Yeah.
They fired him as both. So he had some...
I suspect it was part of the learning curve, Bob, from the Brian Burke situation. And
the other thing is Brian Burke had a year left on his contract or more, so they were paying him a whack of dough. They could have let Brian Colangelo go. They could have got let him walk away and not owed him another cent.
John,
is that or is that not true?
Give me your learning curve theory.
I think the learning curve from the Brian Burke situation was that if we're going to pay a guy to be around, we better give him at least
give him a title
that makes him...
Hold on.
No, but Bob,
but
I know...
But that's mitigated by the fact that Brian had a contract and they had to pay him X millions of dollars. So they're going to give him create a make-work project. I sort of get that.
And as a favor to one of the owners. I truly believe it.
Well, if one of the owners was that powerful or influential, then they wouldn't have fired Brian Colangelo, would they?
Could be a compromise. He loses every vote 4-2. What are you talking about?
So, you know, you snooze, you lose.
Well, we know in the hard world of professional sports what happens to people when they get pushed aside, and Brian Colangelo has been put into a job that I'm not sure what it is, and I'm not sure he's sure what it is. Mm. And he will resurrect himself into the basketball world at some appropriate time over the next 12 to 24 months.
Not necessarily in Toronto, you're saying?
No.
Well, we know it's not in Toronto.
I think, John, I'm with you. I think it's one of those, and the theory, it's easier to find work while you're working as opposed to when you're out of work. And
I think that's the favor that was given to Brian.
Exactly. And I think when you look at, and you know, people are all over this and people don't like to hear me say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. The NBA family always looks after their own, and the Colangelo name carries a certain amount of weight in the NBA family. It does. Jerry, I mean, look at what happened. USA Basketball fell on its face in 2004, a bronze medal in Athens. Jerry, would you come and run USA Basketball? Krzyzewski's coaching. They're like 72. They've lost one game in like 8 years. You know, 2-3 gold medals later, world championships, all of that. The Colangelo name has some clout. And I just didn't think that. And plus, as you said with Larry, I just don't think they wanted to kick him to the curb like that. And just kind of unceremoniously throw him out the door.
It may have been kinder to him, frankly.
To put him to the curb?
Yeah, depending on how they did it. But,
of course
but
it is.
This is putting him in a position in which he has to fail. And he has to be frustrated, and it's got to be just a terrible situation. They talked about him. I mean, I like and respect Brian Colangelo. He had to go because it didn't work. But to torture the guy. I'm sure that at least one, if not two, of the owners liked Brian, respected Brian, wanted him around. And so they kind of found something. But it is such an embarrassment for him. It is crazy part
is
of the statement.
Is it more embarrassing, Gord, than being
yes
fired?
Yes.
And to be around as a president?
Yes, because of the statement that Tim made when he said Brian was staying on as president, and then quickly felt he had to make a statement because of his trying to recruit a new general manager. He had to say, but Brian, of course, you're going to have to listen to the new general manager because he will make all the player personnel decisions.
And report directly to me.
And report directly to me, and you won't have any capacity in that regard. That's a very embarrassing thing to make publicly known the moment you say that Brian's staying on as president. It's very puzzling to me.
Well, it seems to me to be very typical MLSE.
Well, except the irony of all ironies is this is supposed to be the new regime.
Yeah.
This is supposed to be the new philosophy. I think that I don't think you can walk in and say what happened in the last 8 or 9 years when teachers ran the place, or even before that when Steve Stavrou ran the place, is the way the book unfolds now that it's owned by Rogers and Bell.
People hammered the teachers pretty good. And
yeah, I mean,
you don't hammer any ownership group that doesn't win. Well,
the whole concept of having, the Uber boss, the Tim Leiwicki was to put a face to somebody who was supposed to be the stop position. And the board was supposed to move into the shadows again. And Leiwicki was supposed to be and is supposed to be the be-all and end-all. And the world stops at Leiwicki's desk.
Well, but clearly that's not happening because if this is a Larry Tannenbaum initiative because of his fondness for Colangelo, even though he probably got outvoted.
Bobcat, he might have had influence, but if you've hired this guy to do this and he's going to wear this decision, then he's got to be comfortable with it too. Right? We all know that you get to the point, well, if I'm going down, I'm going down my way. And if he has to wear this decision, then he's got to be somewhat comfortable with it, Tim Leiwicki.
I think the key question in all this, Paul, is, and we've been through this before with other people who have come to town with really, really big resumes, is do they underestimate the size of this market? Do they underestimate the complexity of this market? And do they understand the importance of their franchises in this market? And I do wonder that in this situation.
I don't see that as problematic. I mean, I think they've just failed. I don't think it's more complicated than that.
I mean, to me, I think, you're not going to be able to pull one over on anybody in this town. And that should have been the first piece of advice for any new president and CEO coming to town is, by the way, don't try to make this a mockery of telling the truth.
Bobcat, who's failed? They just hired the guy, and that was his decision.
No, this organization has been a failure overall. I mean, they've got 70 years of on the ice, on the court, on the field performance without a championship, but an appearance for a championship. I mean, this is the most dismal record of any organization in professional sport in North America. I mean, it's at that point. I mean, their failure has been colossal on the soccer side. It has been almost as colossal on the basketball side, and it has been dim on the hockey side too. I mean, we're talking 40 plus years. So overall, different ownership, and yet it seems to me the same core mentality of how to do things, and the same core mentality, no matter what you think or what, and I understand everybody wants to win. I don't care whether you're an executive, whether you're a broadcaster, no matter what you do in life, everybody wants to win. So stop with the, they don't want to win. The problem is they don't know how. And if you keep bringing little pieces, especially at the top, but don't change the core infrastructure, I don't see how you're going to change the culture.
So you wanted, let's say you would have said to Tim Leiwicki, come in and just, a couple of sticks of dynamite and blow the whole thing up.
That would have been preferable. It's never been done.
No, I know.
It's never been done. And at some point, do you think everybody that's come in here to run the Leafs, the Raptors, the soccer team, and it's a long bleeping list, are they all stupid? Are they all incompetent? Were they all the subject of some mysterious disease that's floating around Toronto? No, because the infrastructure has remained the same. And at some point, you've got to get rid of those people. And you've got to get rid of that infrastructure.
So you've
got to recreate.
So you're saying they're influencing those people that are coming in.
The biggest problem with MLSE is that they make crap loads of money.
That's right.
And when you make crap loads of money, even though they'll stand there and tell you, well, it's not really what we really want is championships, but we make a lot of money. Behind the scenes, they sit back and say, okay, we want to win championships, so let's lop the head off this dragon and bring a new head in. But we're going to keep the body, and we can substantiate that because we're making loads of money.
Yeah.
We can keep all of the senior executives. We can keep Tom Anselmi. We can keep all of these people because we're making money. They don't really deserve to be dismissed. Well, the answer is yes, they do. At some point, you've got to make a wholesale change in the operation. You know, when Rogers took over Sportsnet years ago, they've gone through two or three dynamic changes in personnel in this place. Some have gone, and some have come back. Mm-hmm. But whenever there's a change at the top, usually there's a change throughout the system. And MLSE has operated in defiance of that. Richard Petty didn't bring in a whole crap load of people when he was running MLSE. Tim Lewicki doesn't appear to be ready to bring in a whole crap load of people.
I don't know.
We'll wait
that.
And see.
I mean,
he will. But his first opportunity to make a substantive change, he doesn't. He does what you would expect MLSE to do.
Yeah, the interesting is that we're told, too, that Tim was not going to come and take over the organization until probably late June. He's coming June the 3rd.
Right.
He'll be here on the ground June the 3rd.
And he was in all the meetings about Colangelo.
And I assume that he's in Denver talking
to Masai Ujiri.
To Ujiri today.
Well, once you fire the general manager, somebody's got to run the place in the absence of, you got a president, but the president can't do anything. It's wacko. They're a bunch of whack jobs.
Well, it's tough, though, when you're making so much money. It is hard to do. I mean, because it is...
Well, not when you're... That's when
you're insulated. You're so insulated.
Well,
no, but you know what? It's really simple. And they speak the words and they don't do the action. The simplicity of it is their right to go out and get a guy that they believe in. Whoever that is. I don't know whether it's Tim or whoever. But you go out and get that guy. But then you empower that person. You don't try to sway the decisions. You said, we've gotten it wrong. We want to win. I agree with you. They do want to win. We've made a lot of money, so we're happy from that point of view. But we want to win. We want to have a successful organization. When we go to the country club, we don't want to be ridiculed by our peers. We want them to say, way to go, nicely done, not what's the matter with your organization. So what you do is you go out and get the right guy, if it's Tim or whoever it is, and let him be. Let him give him the power to do what he needs to do. And I don't think that's happening.
We'll take the break. The roundtable will continue. This is Primetime on The Fan and Sportsnet.
Blue Jays versus Orioles, tonight at 7.
Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Ooh, yeah. Well, all right, we're jamming. I want to jam it with you.
Damn, I hate it. The commercial breaks end. Thanks to our friends at Chili's for feeding us. Chili's Grill and Bar at 22 Colossus Drive. It's hard by Highway 400 and Highway 7. Today we're snacking on boneless buffalo dippers, Southern Smokehouse Big Mouth Bacon Burger, and Southwest Chicken Caesar Salad. Yummy. Ever tried a Chili's Coronita Rita? Get ready because Margarita Madness is just around the corner, only at Chili's Grill and Bar. McCowan, Shannon, Kirk, and Jones around the table. So one of the other stories that grabbed the headlines this week.
For way too long.
Put your mic on.
For way too long.
You know what we're going to talk about? Woods Garcia.
Well, there was something I was going to make a comment about what we were eating, but I thought I'd stay away from that.
Yeah, let's try not to get in more trouble than we already are in. Let's at least make an effort. It could happen, but let's hope it's an accident.
Okay.
Kind of like Sergio.
Like Sergio,
comments.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what do I mean, there's no redemption for this. There's no excuse for it. About the only thing I can say, and I've tried to point this out, and I've had taken some criticism for it, it wasn't like Fuzzy. With Fuzzy, even if he said it off the top of his head and didn't mean anything by it, he then came back a few minutes later and threw, you know, kerosene on the fire.
Made it a full course meal.
Yeah, he made it a full course meal. And he had the opportunity to think about what he'd said, and he made it worse.
Yeah.
At least with Sergio, he made the apology that night, later that night, and then had the media conference and made the apology. It doesn't make it right, but to compare it to what Fuzzy had done, I don't think it was quite as bad. Are we surprised, impressed? What was the reaction from Tiger's reaction, Jones?
I'm not, with competitive guys, I'm not surprised. I mean, we heard back in, you know, November or December, whatever, with Kevin Garnett, what he allegedly said to Carmelo Anthony about, you know, his wife and all that stuff, and they wanted to install microphones at MSG so they could pick all that up.
No, that's because the owner's a nut bar.
Well, but I'm saying, though, when you get into, my point is, you get into the heat of battle and stupid stuff comes out. And this was from the players. Sergio, you were the one that hit it in the water twice at 17, you know, 100 yards, and you're supposed to be a professional golfer. And he was, you know, and the whole thing with Tiger and his backswing, and a marshal came out and said, yeah, I told him he'd hit already. So, I mean, Sergio's got to let that go. He also is perpetuating his own reputation or stereotype as a guy who's complaining. Like, let it go. If he wanted to zing Tiger, he could have said a number of different things and let people imply what they want. You know, the comment was about dinner, right? He could have said, you know, well, who's he going to bring with him? I mean, he could have made some kind of zinger comment that would have got his point across that they're not best buddies and let it go. But to use that one?
There is no excuse for it.
But I'm not surprised. Am I surprised?
But I don't. No. Do you think it was malicious? Do you think there was intent?
No, I think it was stupid. Sergio doesn't
That's
think.
What it was. Yeah. It was stupid.
Yeah.
It was stupid.
I mean, at this point in our lives, to see Tiger Woods as a sympathetic character unto itself is amazing. And that's what's happened for at least 3 or 4 days.
Sergio made him one, though.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Oh, no, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, the thing about it is he could have taken a shot at Tiger. He took a shot at the everybody of color. I mean, this wasn't directed at Tiger. I mean, it may have been intended to be directed at Tiger.
I don't think it was intended to be anything.
But it was stupid. It was insensitive. It was unintelligent. All those things. And I don't have any particular sympathy for Tiger other than whatever I've had before, but I just think it was ultimate stupidity.
So at some point, these two are going to be back on the same golf course together, and soon, at the latest, the United States Open.
Correct.
I don't know whether they're going to play at Memorial.
No, it
next
sounds
week.
Like it's going to be the U.S. Open, Bob.
Okay, but at the U.S. Open.
Great marketing.
So let me give you a hypothetical. Sergio goes over.
They're going to put him in the same group?
No. Sergio, at some point, let's say on the practice team, goes over to Tiger, extends a hand, and says, I apologize. Maybe more elaborately than that, but the essence of what he wants to say is, Tiger, I'm really sorry. How do we respond?
How should Tiger respond?
Should Tiger respond? How do we on the outside looking in respond?
I mean,
does that throw water on the fire?
Sergio's already thrown as much water as he can on it, in my eyes.
No, I think this is a different thing. The news conference was a step. It was a step he had to take, but it's also a step that we would have expected him to take. There would have been pressure on him to take that step, even if he didn't want
from his corporate supporters.
That's correct. For him to take the next step, which is to go in public, not privately, but in public, and say and extend a hand and offer the olive branch.
That's the question, though.
Do you think
Sergio is going to do that, though?
I have no idea, because of the way they dislike each other.
I tell you what.
If I was Sergio's handlers, I would say, you must do that.
And that's the problem, because how many people are going to think, if he does do that, how many people are going to think,
he was pushed.
What a great guy. He did it of the goodness of his heart. He realized he made a boo-boo, and now he's making a nice. I don't think so. I think everybody's going to say the handlers did it, the sponsors did it,
I think the organizers did it.
I don't think it hurts, though, Gordon.
I think it still has to be done.
I agree.
When we come back, the Senators try to avoid elimination tonight against the Penguins. Red Wings shocking the Blackhawks. Boston unable to sweep the Rangers. L.A. inching closer to a possible repeat of Stanley Cup champions. And Alain Vigneault out in Vancouver. Did they fire the wrong guy? Those topics and more. The roundtable continues. This is Primetime Sports.